guns along with books on campus. Lawmakers move ahead with a measure to allow Florida's college students to carry concealed weapons to class. And good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. First Coast Connect, always live on the radio. And we are also now a daily podcast on iTunes. Download our podcast anytime. Just ahead on the show, we'll take your calls. Let us know what you think about this guns on campus proposal. The number to join us, 549-2937. Then later, it's a mouthwatering preview of the hottest ticket in town this weekend. Six Florida chefs joining forces for a unique downtown dinner featuring the flavors of the South. Plus, a conversation with comedian Elaine Boozler as she comes to town. All of that ahead. But first this morning, it is the first bill to advance this year in the Florida House. A committee in Tallahassee this week approved a measure to allow students to carry guns and concealed weapons on the state's college campuses. But the idea is controversial. This is happening just a few months after a shooter injured three people at the Florida State Library. Now, supporters of this idea say it would prevent more campus shootings, like the FSU incident. Opponents argue more guns on campus will make students less safe. We're beginning the hour with a closer look at the issue. Our legal analyst, Rod Sullivan, professor at Florida Coastal School of Law, joins us now with his thoughts. Rod, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Always great to see you. And here's our question to callers. Right now, let us know, what do you think about this idea to allow guns on Florida's college campuses? Give us a call with your thoughts. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. You can email and tweet the show. We also welcome your comments on our Facebook page. So, Rod, the House Criminal Justice Subcommittee approved this in a party line vote. The first bill to advance this year. Let's talk about what this measure would do.
Sure. Well, let's start out with where the law is. You can currently carry or have a weapon in your car, securely encased in your car, if it's in the parking lot of a state university. But you're prohibited, anybody's prohibited from carrying a firearm on campus. What this law would do is say that if you have a concealed weapons permit issued by the state of Florida, you can now carry a concealed weapon, not an open carry, a concealed weapon on your person on a Florida campus. So what do you have to do to get a concealed weapons permit? You have to be over 21 years of age. You have to be fingerprinted. You have to go through a background check. You have to make sure you're not habitually addicted to drugs, alcohol, domestic violence, and the like. And one big caveat that even if this passes, you cannot carry a concealed weapon to any sporting event. So don't go carrying your concealed weapon to the Florida State game or the Florida-Georgia game, because that still would be against the law.
Now, State Representative Greg Stube filed this bill before that shooting incident on the Florida State campus. He's saying, in his view, this will make students more safe. Not everyone agrees with that. We just received an email from the United Faculty of Florida representing the faculty at FSU and the state college system, and they are writing us. We adamantly oppose House Bill 4005 and Senate Bill 176. The rationale is not supported by evidence or common sense. More weapons and more hands don't make for safer campuses, but instead create a climate of fear. This bill ultimately endangers students, staff, and faculty at universities and colleges. This is a very divisive measure.
It is.
Let's talk about the pros and cons.
Mm-hmm.
As we look at the arguments on both sides.
Right. Well, I mean, the pros are that people who have gone to the trouble of getting their concealed weapons permit, who have a virtually non-existent crime rate. The crime rate among concealed weapon holders is less than 0.1%, will be now permitted to continue to carry their concealed weapons on a college campus. So the theory being, and of course a lot of these folks are ex-military or former policemen and all that, the theory is that these people would then be able, should they have their weapon, to intervene in an armed situation. The con is, expressed by the professors who testified at the hearing, was that, there's so much drugs, so much alcohol, so many suicidal people and depressed people on college campuses, that allowing people with concealed weapons permits to have them on campus will make it riskier rather than safer.
The lines are jammed, meanwhile, as we discuss this measure that would allow guns on college campuses. 549-2937 to join the show. Let's get a few of your calls on the air so we can get as many calls as possible during the hour. Lots of callers. Miller on the South Side. Go ahead, Miller. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. You know, we're supposed to be living in a modern, civilized society. To me, you know, this is insane. You know, we've got to look at the big picture. You know, we're going back to the days of the Wild West. That's the way I see it. What are other countries in the world? What are other colleges in the U.S. doing? What are other colleges in, you know, in the rest of the world doing? You know, we've got to look at the bigger picture. It's insane. I'll take this offline. Thank you.
Miller, thanks for the call. How does this compare to other states, Rod?
Well, actually, most other states don't have any prohibition against concealed weapon permit holders carrying their weapons on campus. There are 20 states currently which prohibit it, and there are 7 states which specifically permit it, and most state statutes are silent on the topic.
Now, let's talk for a little bit about what could be a wrinkle in the supporters' plans. It's FSU President John Thrasher, former powerhouse state senator. Of course, there's a special election happening today to fill his seat in our listening area. He is adamantly opposed to the idea. In fact, the legislature was going to lift this ban a few years ago, but Thrasher blocked it because his daughter's friend had died in an accidental shooting at FSU. What are your thoughts about FSU President John Thrasher potentially blocking this from becoming law, still trying to perhaps use his muscle in Tallahassee to speak out against this?
Yeah, well, let's talk about what John Thrasher says is his motivation for being against it. There was a Jacksonville girl, Ashley Cowie. She was a member of the Chi Omega sorority. She was off campus at Florida State University in a frat house when at 1 o'clock in the morning, when there were alcohol and marijuana being used, somebody brought out a hunting rifle, showed it to her, and it was accidentally discharged, killing her and passing through the wrist of somebody else who was on campus. So this bill really wouldn't affect this because that happened off campus with not a concealed weapon, and obviously it was a serious fatal. I mean, it was a fatal accident that was in horrible circumstances. Can John Thrasher now use his power as president of Florida State to to block the bill? I don't think so. I mean, I think that his role now is diminished to the point where his primary responsibility is getting funding for his college, and that this is an issue that's statewide. So he may speak against it, but I'm not sure how many votes he will sway.
And we have jam lines on this topic as we go now to Evan in Riverside. Good morning, Evan. What are your thoughts?
Thanks so much for taking my call. Of your show.
Thanks.
I just wanted to go ahead and, for this would be kind of a small point, but I went to FSCJ, which is a great community college here, and there were a lot of high schoolers going to that campus. So in some of my classes, there'd be 2 or 3 16-year-olds taking college courses for one reason or another, and that, you know, I'm not a parent or anything close to it. But I know that I wouldn't really want my high schooler to be around people that with concealed weapons. It's almost like by that logic, we should allow high schoolers to carry guns too. And I know that I don't want that. So I'll go ahead and take my call off the air.
All righty. That's Evan in Riverside. And Rod Sullivan, the professors and university officials that have come out against this, and they testified in this subcommittee, they made much the same argument. They said students are still emotionally immature. They're going through issues. They're going out and partying. They don't see this as responsible to let kids that young, whether they're, you know, of high school or even young college age, to carry on campus. What do you think?
Well, first of all, nobody that young can carry on campus. 21 is the minimum age at which you can get a concealed weapons permit. One of the things that the proponents pointed out at the hearing was that you can carry a concealed weapon right up to the borders of a college campus. You can carry them in the Walmart that's across the street or the McDonald's that's across the street. And we're setting up an imaginary boundary on college campuses and say, but not past this point. And I think therein lies the question.
And if you're just joining the show, very hot topic today as Florida Coaster's Rod Sullivan joins us. It's a proposal, the first measure to advance in the Florida House this year that would allow guns and concealed weapons on the state's college campuses. We'll go to your emails and tweets, and they are coming in fast in just a minute. The number to join us, 549-2937, and lots of calls. Let's go now to Richard on the South Side. Hi, Richard.
Hi. I wanted to make a couple of points. You know, one is that I think there's a reason why so many of the recent mass shootings have been on college campuses. Anybody who's been there can tell you that, you know, going through college can be extremely stressful. You're often separated from family and other supports. The idea that having somebody in the classroom, if there should be a shooting, to sling some more bullets around will somehow help things is utterly ridiculous. I was in the courthouse downtown the other day, and I was refused entry because I had a nail clippers with a 1-inch nail file. Now, this is how well lawmakers protect themselves. When I see them saying it's good and okay and permissible to carry concealed weapons into courthouses, police stations, legislatures, city councils, then I'll really believe that, you know, that they believe their own rhetoric. Until then, as far as I'm concerned, it's posturing for, you know, to show how much I love guns, preparing for the next election, and it's nothing else than that. Thank you.
That's Richard on the South Side. As he points out, here's where concealed weapons are banned in the state: grade schools, prisons, courthouses, polling places. The sponsor of this bill is saying when he filed it, he referenced the 2007 Virginia Tech massacre that killed 32 people. His argument, Rod Sullivan, is that gun-free zones don't prevent shootings from taking place. What about the caller's argument that there's hypocrisy on the part of lawmakers because these other places around the state prohibit weapons?
I think that what the lawmakers were arguing at the hearing anyway was that in many of these places, like courthouses and the state legislature building and the like, there are already metal detectors, there are armed guards around to provide protection, and that therefore you know, it's not necessary for people to carry weapons to protect themselves in these locations. Whereas on a college campus, the only ones who, I mean, the sheriff of St. Johns County made a good point. He said the bad guys already carry their weapons on campus, and all this does is permit the quote-unquote good guys from carrying theirs. And I think that's the point that the legislators would make, too, is that the laws against carrying concealed weapons on campus only prevent law-abiding persons from carrying guns. The ones who are going to violate the law are going to carry them on campus anyway.
There was a UNF case as well. Let's discuss that. A student on the UNF campus filed a lawsuit over this, correct?
She did. And former Mayor Delaney and UNF fought this tooth and nail.
They fought her argument that she wanted to carry on campus.
Right. Her argument was that she would feel safer if she was allowed to carry her concealed weapon on campus or into the school. Actually, I got this wrong. Let me make back up. Her argument was that if she couldn't keep a concealed weapon in her car securely encased, that she was at risk every place she went because she couldn't put her gun in her car to go to shopping and then take it out to go to school and vice versa. So she wanted to keep her gun inside her car on campus. And UNF said, no, that's a violation of our policy. We will kick you out. That case went up to the first DCA in Tallahassee. It was heard en banc, which means every single judge in the first DCA heard it and said, no, UNF, you do not have the right to tell somebody they can't keep a gun securely encased in their car.
And that's where things have stood until now.
The way the law stands right now. You can keep a gun in your car on a college campus securely encased.
Lots of calls. Let's go to Dave in Pontevedra. Hi, Dave. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm horrified to hear this kind of news. This is so scary. I have young children. I'm an older parent. I've been around for a while. But I see what I see is a continuing buildup of arms in society. And now we're bringing it out to the university campuses. And my opinion is that this is all fueled by conservative, so-called conservative politics, which we really should be calling reactionary politics. They're actually trying to roll back time 100 years, arm everybody on the streets, and make everybody scared. And a lot of this is based in racism. And I'll take my response off the air.
That's Dave in Ponte Vedra. Let's discuss the politics of this. Rod Sullivan, the Florida House, obviously behind this, it will face a tougher battle in the state Senate. And of course, the arguments that some of these callers are making are sure to come up at that point. What are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, almost all of the speakers who spoke against the bill before the legislature were members of college Democrats or local Democrat organizations, or they were college professors. So, you know, this is definitely something that divides along party lines, divides along liberal and conservative lines, and it will probably continue to be voted on in that particular way.
It's interesting, though, I have to say, though, to see a prominent Republican like John Thrasher, who's the president of FSU now, come. He's had a personal family experience that has perhaps it shifted his position on this.
Apparently it did.
Because his daughter's friend died in a gun accident.
Yeah, he indicated before 2011 he was sitting on the fence, and that 2011 incident where Ashley Cowie died pushed him over against this. But, you know, I think that there was a story on the other side, one of the legislators told, which was about his daughter who was in an elementary school. He got a tweet from her that there was a gun on the campus. They were locked down. They were cowering inside their classroom. And he said that pushed him the other way because he thought the fact that there were no guns on campus on a school basis made that school a particular target. So I think that people get emotionally involved, certainly in both ways.
Certainly, judging by the feedback we're getting, yes, lots of calls, emails, and tweets. Let me get a few of them on the air. You mentioned college professors speaking out strongly. We have an email now from one. Paul emails the show. As a college professor, I know how upset students get when they fail a class, test, or exam, and they transfer the blame to us. The idea that a student you're delivering bad news to may have a gun in his pocket is very troubling. Most of our kids are great citizens, but many are also not emotionally mature, and adding guns to the mix of a stressful environment seems to be not well thought out. Now, here are lots of tweets coming into the show, both for and against. Here's a tweet from one listener. I am fine with this whole idea as long as it's done legally. But then some against as well, saying more guns in more places means more chances for accidents. It's statistics 101. And here's a question. From Kingsley on Twitter, does any part of the law require carriers to disclose their firearm to a professor or an instructor?
No. As a matter of fact, it would be sort of the opposite. The law requires you to keep your weapon concealed, to not expose it to anybody. And therefore, there's nothing. First of all, you have to understand this is not a new law that's being passed. This is an old law that is being repealed. The concealed weapons permit law says there are 13 places where you cannot carry a concealed weapon. One of those is state colleges. So what they're doing is they're taking away that prohibition. So it's really a very small bill. It takes out about three lines of currently existing statute that prohibits the carrying of concealed weapons on college campuses.
And we're getting lots of tweets about whether it's legal to have a gun in your car on campus. People are tweeting us saying, UNF has a policy of no guns even in cars. The whole thing was overruled in court. Let's clarify that.
Yeah, no, the UNF lost that case, lost it big. The First District Court of Appeals said that UNF has no authority to prevent people from carrying securely encased weapons in their cars. And I say they lost it big because they had to pay the woman's attorney's fees, which was a fairly substantial amount of money as well. So there's really no question about that now. The law is you can carry a weapon in your car on a state college campus as long as it is securely encased.
Okay, let me reply back to that listener and let him know that on Twitter. At the same time, here are a few comments on our Facebook page. Laura, I just graduated from UNF. The campus police do a good job protecting students. Guns should not be allowed on campus. They are allowed to be kept in vehicles, and I think that is enough. And Sarah, this is absurd. As an educator and a parent, this is frightening to me. I would not send my daughter to any university that would allow this. But we're getting calls both for and against. We want your calls. Let's go to Theo in Atlantic Beach now. Hi, Theo. Go ahead.
Good morning. 3 points. One, I think it's a really sad commentary on our society that regardless of Democrat or Republican, once a black man was elected to president, gun sales nationally shot through the roof. Second point is that with those high gun sales, the existing system of doing background checks failed miserably because it is not funded to the extent that it can accommodate the headcount that's going through on high purchase days, like after Thanksgiving or Christmas area. The Wall Street Journal had a recent article that stated that during those typical crush buying periods, that only about one out of three background checks are successfully completed within the three-day mandatory delivery system, and so people can get guns if they would not pass a background check. They can get guns by merely buying on those crush days. And the third thing is that because of doctor-patient privilege, people who are mentally deranged, such as the Sandy Hook killer, would not come into being screened whatsoever. And there's just too many flaws in this thing that make it unsafe. I think it's a horrendous idea, and I'm ashamed of the people who are purporting to see some sort of light at the end of the tunnel with this idea. Thank you.
That's Theo in Atlantic Beach. Rod Sullivan.
Yeah, I mean, a number of your callers have mentioned race, and I don't know that I see that here. Most of the school shooters have been non-African-Americans. I mean, the Virginia Tech was an Asian-American. The Adam Lanza, Sandy Hook, was a young white male. Myron May at Florida State was African-American lawyer. But I don't really see this as crossing racial lines so much as it does political lines.
Fritz on the West Side. Hey, Fritz, what are your thoughts?
Okay, yes, I'm calling. My wife is a full-time student at UNF, and we are both gun owners. I believe it's absurd that everyone, it seems, at least has been calling in, is against this. Me and my wife are 100% behind all the police forces, campus police, and all of that, but stuff still happens. There are still shootings across the country. It makes me feel better knowing that my wife might be able to carry her concealed weapon with her.
And that's Fritz on the West Side. Fritz, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Rod.
Well, Fritz mentions about there being on-campus police, and a number of people have mentioned this too. And one of the things that was pointed out at the hearing is that in the Strozier Library shooting, there were 4 minutes between the 911 call and the arrival of police, but that 4 minutes was enough for three people to get shot. The same thing was true in the Sandy Hook shooting. It took 4 minutes for the police to get there, 11 minutes for them to get to the shooter, but in that period of time, he was able to shoot, 20 children and injure six others. So the close proximity of police doesn't really seem to make us much safer when it comes to these school shooting incidents. And the question really is, are we going to increase the risk of an accidental shooting or suicide by allowing a concealed weapons permit holder to carry their gun on campus, or are we going to create a deterrent for people like Adam Lanza or Mr. May to go on campus feeling like they have nobody who's going to challenge them?
And there's a lot of data that that people on both sides of this issue will refer to when they make their arguments. People who are against this will make the argument that more guns don't necessarily deter. Pro-gun advocates have their own set of numbers, by the way. And meanwhile, we have so many calls on this. It's not a surprise. Let's get a few more of you on the air. Jay in Springfield. Go ahead, Jay.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
What this does is turn a situation where there may be one shooter into a situation where there may be three or four or multiple shooters trying to find the first shooter, and then the police show up not sure who is the actual the person who's actually out to try and kill people. So, I mean, even the police accidentally shoot bystanders. So to me, this creates a much more dangerous situation with folks acting to protect themselves, and then you have thousands of college students running scared, professors, all these folks. This doesn't seem to, this creates a much more dangerous situation for everybody involved, in my opinion.
Thank you, Jay. Let's go down to Tim in Orange Park. Hi, Tim. What are your thoughts?
Places like Sandy Hook don't happen when there are people armed. Guns kill people. People don't kill people. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Walter in Pontevedra. Go ahead, Walter.
I called to make the same point, basically. You know, this argument that, you know, a good guy with a gun will, you know, is necessary to defeat a bad guy with a gun. But so, like in the FSU library, somebody starts shooting, and somebody else pops up and starts shooting also. Now, how does everybody else know who the bad guy is, who the good guy is, or whether it's two bad guys? I mean, this is very simple. There's a reason that policemen wear uniforms. So you know who the good guy with the gun is. It seems very simple to me. As far as the data and facts, just look at our country compared to every other civilized country and the amount of gun violence we have here because of the saturation of guns in our society. That's perfectly obvious. You don't need to be a statistician to know that. Those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Walter. And lots of calls. We're trying to get as many of you included in the conversation as we can before we go on. Let's bring on Jeremy in St. Augustine. Hi, Jeremy. Go ahead.
Yes. Good morning. My sister attends Santa Fe, and if something like that happened where she was and there was another student who was concealing a weapon and was able to prevent that, that student would be held as a national hero. They wouldn't be beaten down and barrauded. Everyone seems to think this is the Wild West, and everyone that has a concealed weapon is a bad person. When most of these people are, you know, retired soldiers or people who have gone through training, know how to handle a weapon. You know, if I had a son or daughter in class and that had happened, and somebody was able to intervene, I mean, that would mean the world to me. And I'm sure people who have lost their sons and daughters would feel that way too. It just seems a little naive for people to have a general consensus that everyone carrying a concealed weapon is dangerous, and that, you know, lives cannot be saved, because this is America, and we're losing our rights slowly, day by day, and I feel plain and simple that I would be proud to carry a weapon in class and to do my duty as an American to prevent something as tragic as that happening. Thank you very much.
That's Jeremy in St. Augustine. Jeremy, thanks for the call. Meanwhile, we're getting tweets about that topic. Georgette, while those who have a permit to conceal carry are not the ones who may be committing the shooting, they don't always have the right training on how to react with a firearm in high stress situations like the police. And the situation, she goes on to say, she sent us a bunch of tweets, is complicated when police arrive at the scene. How can they distinguish between an active shooter and the students? No shortage of opinions here.
No. And of course, that was discussed at length in the hearings, too. And I think one of the legislators pointed out that the in this type of situation, the bad guy is usually the guy on the ground. The good guy is the guy standing over him, not shooting at police and calling for the police to come over. I don't know if there is enough data to suggest one way or another that, you know, you can draw any conclusions.
Mary in Jacksonville Beach. Hey, Mary, thanks for holding. What are your thoughts?
Thank you so much for taking my call. I just want to start off, we're not comparing apples to oranges here. First of all, Sandy Hook were elementary students. We're talking about 21-year-old college students. The majority of them are out partying at night the next day, barely walking through the door. The statistics will show the majority will be boys carrying a concealed weapon, thinking it's cool, having it in class. Let's get back to the basics. We're going to college to receive an education. That's what the major, you know, focus should be. This whole thing of now we're allowing students to carry weapons into the university, I'm appalled. I'm even appalled that we're having this conversation. It's black and white. There's no gray area. There's no need for having a bunch of soldiers running around saving the day, which would create more of a chaotic environment. And it's not going to cause any more protection. You see what happens when you have more people who are not trained getting involved in chaotic situations. It creates a more chaotic situation. And thank you so much. You have a great day.
That's Mary in Jack's Beach. Rod Sullivan, it will be interesting to see how much pressure, let's assume this goes all the way through the Florida House and goes on to the Florida Senate, how vocal educators and parents will be, as we're hearing on this program, will they be more vocal than those who support the idea as they lobby the legislature?
That's certainly the evidence from the hearing. I mean, the vast majority of speakers were opposed to the legislation. I think there were maybe just two or three people who stood up in favor of the legislation. I think it's sort of the situation where you have a silent majority out there who are not going to get up and get involved in this issue, and a vocal, more vocal minority that's going to get up and speak against it. it certainly seems to me like they have the votes in the legislature to get this passed.
Mike on the South Side. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. I was sort of pleased to hear the previous caller talk about how universities and schools need to be safe zones. They need to be, I think they need to be sacred areas. In my own dorm, I found a dorm mate with a .357 Magnum, chrome-plated. It easily could have shot through the four walls between us and killed my roommate and myself. I turned him in. I also used to shred police reports for the University of Florida. And just the crime statistics that we're talking about on campuses. Campuses are already challenged with the assaults and so forth like that. If we have to have detectors and magnetometers at every entry point to universities, I'm for that. But we must keep the weapons, the guns, and the types of people that own these guns and who believe that they will protect them. We've got to keep them out of our schools.
That is, that's Mike on the South Side. Thank you, Mike. And some questions are coming into the show. Let's ask our law professor, Linda. Who will provide liability insurance if a student gets shot by friendly fire? And Jamie, has anyone considered what this bill might do to enrollment at state universities? As a parent of teenagers going to college soon, I would be hesitant to allow my kids to attend a school that allows guns. What about those questions?
Well, the liability issue is actually something that was addressed in the hearings. And one of the legislators said that he thought we ought to be liable, that if we're going to create a zone where there are no guns and people can protect themselves and then somebody gets shot and we haven't provided additional security to protect them, that maybe we as the state ought to be responsible for those shootings. Now, as to who's going to be responsible if somebody gets shot by a concealed weapons permit holder, the university doesn't have any way of knowing who is a concealed weapons permit holder or not. So that's going to be basically the responsibility of the individual who shoots and their potential liability for shooting the wrong person or for a stray bullet.
Aaron in Atlantic Beach. Go ahead, Aaron.
Hi. I am a professor at UNS, and I'm calling because of the point of thinking that this is a deterrent to gun violence. Most of these shooters are killing themselves after they do their violence. So I'm not comfortable with the argument that this is a deterrent. Thank you.
All right, Aaron. My goodness, so many calls today. Sorry we couldn't get y'all on the air. Rod Sullivan, this has passed a committee. So now it goes before it will go on to the full Florida House and then and through the process from there. What do you think, if it does make it all the way to the governor's desk, do you think he'll veto it, or would he allow this to go through?
I've never really heard Governor Scott give an opinion one way or another on these gun rights issues. But it would seem to me that if it passes both houses of the legislature, I'm not sure that he would want to stand up and fight against both the NRA, the legislators who voted for it, and those people who hold concealed weapons permits, which are over a million two in the state of Florida. So there's a lot of concealed weapons permit holders out there who probably would be upset if the governor vetoed this.
We'll have to follow it. In the meantime, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Our legal analyst, Rod Sullivan, with Florida Coastal School of Law. And later in the hour, two of the top chefs in town join the show to talk about Florida's Sunday Supper, a very hot event happening this weekend downtown. We'll tell you all about it. But up next,
the nice, funny, good show, old school, punchlines.
Don't miss it. It's a conversation with comedian Elaine Boozler, sharing her love of laughter and her love of animals. That's next.
Spend some time in The Square, an online venue for local artists. WJCT and the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville invite you to vote for your favorite submissions. Vote now through the end of the month. To learn more about The Square and to place your vote, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Lourdes Garcia,
Alice Fusion,
Ari Shapiro,
NPR News,
Monrovia,
Sao Paulo,
Beirut,
London. Reporting from bunkers, streets, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings beginning at 5 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the Beatles on air live at the BBC, Volume 2. We talk with Kevin Howlett, the album's executive producer. It collects recordings of the Beatles performing originals and covers and chatting with BBC hosts in the early 1960s. Howlett also wrote the book, The Beatles, the BBC Archives. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Welcome back. Well, legendary comedian Elaine Boozler is coming to town this week. Her performance this Thursday night at the Jacksonville Comedy Club is sure to bring lots of laughs. But it's also for a great cause, the city's animal rescue effort. I spoke with Elaine about her career in comedy. Take a listen. Elaine Boozler, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So you're very funny, lots of excitement that you're coming into town. And we also need to point out you are an animal rescue advocate, and you'll be donating a portion of the proceeds from your night at the Comedy Club to Friends of Jacksonville Animals. Is that right?
That is right. The first night on a Thursday, they get a big piece of the door and all the good loot we sell after the show, which is manufactured for My Tales of Joy, which is my rescue. They're going to get 100% of that.
Excellent. What motivates you to get involved with this particular issue?
Well, I started Tales of Joy about 19 years ago. You can find it on the net at talesofjoy.net. And I had been on the road for years. It's about 40 years by now. But I've seen so much rescue across the country. And I kind of noticed that you'd have three old ladies in Ohio saving more cats by themselves than the entire bloated Humane Society of the United States, and realized with a little help, you know, all of these mom-and-pop rescues could do a lot of great stuff. And so basically I launder money. Tales of Joy fundraises for the smallest, neediest rescues across the country. And after my shows, I pick a couple of rescues in each city, sell all the merchandise, and leave 100% of it behind.
Excellent. So a serious cause, but of course you're coming into town to make people laugh. You've done stand-up all over the world, a huge fan base. Is there really nothing like getting in front of a live audience? I would think that never gets old.
Well, no, it doesn't. I mean, it's kind of the last live thing left when you think about it.
Yeah.
Really, even presidential debates are scripted now. You're never going to see a good fist fight break out or, you know, someone ask a good follow-up question of the other guy. It's kind of just the last live, interactive, unpredictable, at least for me, because I like the act to be wild, and I like if they're feisty and they have a lot to say. And, you know, there's a big difference between heckling and participating. And I just love it because it's kind of like skywriting. As the audience leaves, it fades, and, you know, you just had to be there.
Now, I have to ask you this. Is it really true, as the urban legend goes, that the character of Elaine on Seinfeld was based on you?
No, it was based on Carol Leifer.
Oh, that's right.
She kind of came up in the group after the group I came up with and dated Jerry for a while, and they're still friends to this day. And she was kind of the girl in that group, where I was kind of the girl in my group. So it really was Carol, I believe.
How funny. But if you were when you were coming up in comedy, you were the one girl, as you said, in a group of guys. That can be tough. I would think it was tough to break into stand up, and it probably still is for women. It's a macho kind of field, isn't it? Even today?
Well, you know, the world is a macho field, so it's always harder for women anywhere that had been basically male-dominated. But for me, it was fantastic because there really was no stand-up to break into. I started in 73, and stand-up wasn't this big financial juggernaut that it is today. It was a couple of guys who did it as a hobby and all had day jobs because there was no money in it. And, you know, they were just so welcoming and great. It was kind of the first family I ever had. And my group was, well, me and Jay Leno, Andy Kaufman, Freddie Prinze, Jimmy Walker, Richard Belzer, it was just great. And then maybe a couple of years later in California, we added Robin Williams to that and David Letterman. And, you know, so it's just kind of this amazing group of talented people who did it for love, which is why they were so good at it. And now it's kind of a business that people can choose or not choose or go to school for. But, you know, it's funny the way it's changed. It also hasn't, because, you know, 40 years ago, there were 10 great comics in the whole world. And now there's a million comics and 10 great comics in the whole world. So, you know, it changes and it doesn't.
But it says a lot about your talent and your staying power over the years you've been doing it.
I think it just says that I couldn't make a living at anything. I mean, people say, how'd you start? And they say, let's see, I got fired from all the A's, all the B's. I got to C, C-O-M. I didn't get fired. I stayed.
Oh, how funny. Well, it's exciting to get to talk to you. And of course, you're a great friend of the animals. And it's great to have you coming to town on that, on their behalf. So thank you so much.
Thank you, and I'll actually be there for 3 nights, and we'll be donating to them the whole time. So I hope people will come out. It's a nice, funny, good show, old school, punchlines.
That's Elaine Boozler. Catch her act this week and this weekend. She kicks it off Thursday night, the 29th, at the Jacksonville Comedy Club. A portion of the proceeds will benefit Friends of Jacksonville Animals. Back in a moment with a preview of the hottest ticket in town, the Flavors of the South, served up in an historic building. We'll tell you all about it next.
Football helped Corey Parker escape a rough Detroit neighborhood. Now he's helping high school players as their coach.
When I got here, you had so many guys that made a decision to be the thug, and they always played and started here. I said, I'm going to change all of that.
That story and the latest on the Northeast Blizzard, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Weekdays at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Fresh music from around the world tonight at 9, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9. Your community, your world, your music.
Don't wait up for me, darling. I'm not coming home. Draw the blinds and set the alarm, 'cause I'm.
Well, finally, this hour, it's going to be one mouth-watering event. This weekend, 6 Florida chefs are teaming up for a special dinner benefiting the prestigious James Beard Foundation. But this isn't any your ordinary event, charity event. Diners will get together in an interesting location. Downtown Jacksonville's historic Marble Bank Building is part of the Laura Street Trio. Florida's Sunday Supper will spotlight the flavors of the South, and this is all part of the very hot Legend Series, an ongoing pop-up dining event happening at the most interesting and unusual spots all around town. Chef Scotty Schwartz of 29 South and Chef Tom Gray of Moxie Kitchen and Cocktails are here now with a delicious preview, guys. Good to see you.
Nice to see you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us on.
So great to see you both. In a minute, we'll talk about the Legend Series. But first, tell us about Saturday night. What's on the menu? What's going to be happening? Tom?
We're not allowed to divulge the
menu
yet.
Oh, you can't give the menu away.
Nice try, Melissa. People try to trip us up all the time.
That's right. But that's why this is so exciting, because people can't wait to be part of these events. There's an element of surprise to this.
Absolutely. And most of our Legend Series events, the people buy their tickets. They have absolutely no idea where they're going to until the morning of the event. They're emailed, be here at this time, wear this, but they still have no idea what they're eating, what they're doing, entertainment, etc. And this is a Legends production, and it's going to be done in the Legends style, but You know, it's just for a great foundation.
Yeah, this benefits the James Beard Foundation. The whole idea is you get the best culinary talents together, and diners show up at all kinds of crazy places. You did one in a parking garage.
Yep.
Now you're doing all kinds of locations.
We've been
now,
in a cemetery. We've been,
cemetery.
Now you're gonna, warehouses.
Ford factories. Yeah.
Now you're going to be in this abandoned old bank building.
Yes.
So what? It's like a renegade dinner. What are some of the challenges of serving up a world-class meal in a building like this?
It is very challenging, but it is exciting because you go into these spaces with no infrastructure and you figure out how to make it happen. You rub two sticks together, make some fire,
almost, right?
Pretty much.
But you have to really think it through, and we're doing beautiful food and amazing spaces, and these beautiful dining rooms are created on a moment's notice, so it's they're just really incredible.
Right, you take an abandoned space or an unusual space, and you really make it gorgeous. Mm-hmm. That's the other part of it, isn't it?
Absolutely. If you were to look at our parking garage event, I mean, it was a parking garage that you would park your car in any day in Jacksonville, and it was turned into a five-star dining room. I mean, it was absolutely amazing.
And that one had to change on a dime because of weather. We were supposed to be on the roof, and we had to move the entire party down a floor and reset a kitchen and a dining room. So.
Wow. And now at this event, it's going to be the chefs from Four Rivers Smokehouse, mm-hmm. Orsé, Taverna, 29 South, Moxie Kitchen, and Black Sheep, some of the best chefs in the region. You're not going to give the menu away, but it's the flavors of the South, right?
Absolutely. This is a Southern-style dinner. John Rivers was the one that kind of pulled us all together for this. He's the host chef. It was his idea. And what we wanted to do is focus on the foods of North Florida, because as people think of the cuisine of Florida, they immediately think South Florida, Floridian, salsas, mango, chutneys, and things like that. And that's really not indicative of our food style, especially, north of Orlando.
Now, at the same time, Scotty, you're going to open a restaurant in this building. That's in your future as well, right?
Absolutely. We have signed a lease, and we are shopping designers right now for the Marble Bank space. It'll be called the Bullbriar. And we look forward to being closer to town. My restaurant's up on Amelia Island, and I'm tired of packing box lunches for all my friends to come up and visit me up there. So I'll be a little bit closer for everybody.
Yeah. And as the Laura Street Trio gets developed, what a prime spot for you. Meanwhile, Tom Gray, your Moxie Kitchen has taken off amazingly well over at the St. John's Town Center.
Yes, thank you. Yep. We are just now a year old, a little over a year old. And it has been fantastic. It's been a great growing experience for us and the evolution of the restaurant.
Now, I've never been inside that building, driven by it a million times, the Marble Bank building. What's it look like in there?
It's a throwback to 1902.
Really? I mean,
it's beautiful.
Giant, plaster cornices and wrought iron work. And, the building's made out of marble. And then, down below the main level, which is absolutely beautiful, you have about 3,000 square feet of vaults and space downstairs, including a tunnel that used to run under Jacksonville.
Oh, man. Now, are the diners going to get to see the old bank vault?
Not on this one.
We
still have liability issues when it comes to that, but I'll take you down there anytime you want to take a visit.
Oh, I think I see a web series in my future with some photographs. That sounds so fascinating. But anything else? Any more little peek inside the curtain you can give us? Because the whole reason this has been so successful, these Legend series, is there's this element of shock and surprise. Mm-hmm. So I know you don't want to give too much away. But what else? But I'm asking you anyway. What else can you tell us?
I think maybe a little bit further into that is that we were all given a state to focus on. Mm-hmm. And so we did. There is focus for the chef to develop each dish, and every time we do these events, we try to challenge ourselves. And so I actually chose my birth state because I've never cooked, which is Virginia. And I've never cooked anything specifically focused on that. So that I wanted to take the time to do a little bit of research and
what are we talking? Virginia ham.
There might be some of that.
Maybe.
There's a chance you might see some of that.
Oh, I got some of the menu on the air. How about that? Maybe. What about you, Scotty? Can you give us a hint what you're cooking up?
Well, I am originally from Atlanta, and of course they gave me Georgia, which is perfect.
Peaches.
That's what there's not any peaches because they're not in season right now. But if you think of South Georgia sporting life, you might get a little.
Some
that's
kind
the best
of
hint
seafood,
I'm going to give you.
Maybe or game.
Maybe some game.
Game. Okay. Yeah. Now, how competitive are all you guys with each other when you all get together and you're cooking alongside each other? Is there this sense of I want my dish to be the one everybody loves the best?
Of course.
I was waiting to see if you were going to be honest with that, Tom. Of course there is. But, the thing is that we're all such good friends. We, outside of the Legends series and everything else, we hang out together. We do dinner parties. We're at each other's kids' birthday parties. So, but there's still that little bit of...
We don't keep that a secret amongst ourselves. We actually spend a lot of time brainstorming and giving each other help. Like, what about this? Or if you think that, and, to help the dishes run as smoothly and cohesively as possible.
Now, the big question I know everyone listening to this has, because their mouths are watering, is, are there any tickets left?
No.
Is it sold out?
Yeah, this one sold out in less than 3 seconds.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
But sign up for the next one because you need to get on the mailing list for the Legend Series. Just go to thelegendseriesjax.com, and you too can be part of these amazing culinary events. Guys, it's such a treat to talk to you both. Have a wonderful evening. I know it's going to be memorable. Thank you both, and have fun out there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
And I want to see those bang faults, by the way.
You have a chance.
When we were joined by Chef Scotty Schwartz of 29 South, look out for his new restaurant coming to downtown Jacksonville, the Bull Briar. And Chef Tom Gray of Moxie Kitchen and Cocktails, two of the chefs participating in this Saturday night's big event, part of the Legend Series, benefiting the James Beard Foundation. It's Florida's Sunday Supper. TheLegendSeriesJax.com to get on the list for the next one. And that's our program. Thanks so much for listening. The show's theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Shevchuk. And make sure to catch our daily podcasts. If you ever miss a live show, they are now up on iTunes. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.